Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, it's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate, for people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate.
Hello, everyone. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Garden State Debate podcast and videocast. My name's Ryan, and just a quick reminder, I haven't mentioned this other than in messaging in many of the previous episodes, but you can find the podcast on YouTube, just Garden State Debate. You can also find it on all audio streaming platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, everything, just by searching for Garden State Debate. So it's on both video and audio platforms. And I also want to give a shout out, haven't done this in a while either, actually on the show, to Jairus Cook, who is the professional musician who created the jingle to start the show. So thank you to Jairus. But to get back to today's special guest, we have on with us Colleen Wilson from the Bergen Record, also the USA Today network. Colleen Wilson is about a 5-year tenure at the Bergen Record. So it'll be interesting to get some background on what led Colleen Wilson in her career to where she's at now. But she is the transit reporter for all things transit in New Jersey and often linkage with New York. As you probably know, if you've watched the show, I ride New Jersey Transit daily, not as much during the pandemic, but more so now in getting back to work. So we'll be talking about some of the stuff that Colleen's seeing as she's just written a story about people getting back to work and some of the preparedness around it from New Jersey Transit. So not to waste any more time, just want to welcome you, Colleen. Welcome to the show. How's everything going? I see you've been very busy in the last several days, putting out a lot of stories.
Hey, Ryan. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on your podcast. I've been a listener for some time and enjoyed Senator Weinberg and Assemblyman Johnson's interview from earlier. So anyway, but yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a good point. We've had Weinberg a couple times talking about transit, talking about reform bills, and hopefully we can get into some of that. And also your colleague, Dustin Rasiopi, was on earlier. So it's good to have to have you back now to be on the show, talk a little bit to us about transit. So I guess first question for you is, how did you get your career? Where did you start your career? What's the Colleen life story from a professional standpoint that led you to the Bergen Record and reporting on transit?
Yeah, well, like I said earlier, I don't think my path is quite as interesting as Dustin's, but I'm from Maryland originally. So I went to school at University of Maryland. And when I graduated, I had an internship opportunity in New York City. So I came up to do that. And the way I always tell is I just pretty much never left. And so I had months later from that ending, I ended up at the Westchester County Business Journal, which was a weekly paper, kind of a dying art, the business journal, the weekly kind of newspaper world. But anyway, I learned a lot there, got my feet wet doing that and learning about certainly the Westchester County area of New York. And then I was there for about a year, and then I went to LoHUD, which is within the Gannett Company and the Westchester. They cover Westchester and Rockland County and some of Putnam. And I covered education for them. And so there's like 40 school districts there, and it was a really busy beat, but it helped me kind of learn how to take a very large beat and try to distill it down, figure out what matters to parents, people, students, things like that. Found a couple scandals, you know, there under a couple of rocks. So that was always, that kept me on my feet, or on my toes rather. And then I got asked if I wanted to consider the transportation beat in New Jersey. So I decided to take that opportunity. So I haven't been doing the beat for 5 years, but I did start in the summer of 2019 on transportation beat. So,
okay. So the 5 years was the.
With low HUD.
Got it. So, wow. Only a couple of years then. So
yeah,
you came up to speed pretty quickly. Did you have any prior transit experience even from
riding? Just a subway rider, a New York City. I lived in New York City, so I just took subways and buses.
You've been around it.
But yeah, I mean, I really didn't know anything about New Jersey transit. I mean, the state, the politics, all of that I've come to figure out pretty quickly. I have great colleagues at The Record who have been super helpful as far as helping me understand the context of different issues, who the people are, who, you know, the power players, I suppose, and helping me, you know, learn more about the state and how it works and the legislature and that sort of thing.
That's really interesting. The fact that going just in a couple of years to what we're about to be talking about. So I guess it's just a question on that is like developing contacts. Like, it seems like you have a lot of resources, and people to go to, or do people come to you? And like, is there a general like way that someone in your business kind of reporting on transit, how did you get so comfortable? And from what I'm seeing, so natural at keeping up with the almost daily stories so quickly.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, I find that that's the interesting thing about jumping into a new beat, and especially not being from this area or from New York. You know, it was the same with the education beat. Like, you, it really made you go out and meet people. It made you want to be out in the field, not in the office. And I think it just makes you be a little bit more, you know, on top of it and reaching out and stuff like that. I also think you come in with eyes wide open, no preconceived ideas or notions about what you're covering, which is kind of nice. I think it helped me, I think, be a better reporter in a sense. But I think as far as developing sources, it's a combination of both me having to just kind of, you know, sometimes have to scramble and frantically start Googling and emailing or asking colleagues like, okay, who's a good professor or some an expert who can weigh in on this topic or that topic, or having to figure out, okay, what is congestion pricing? How does that work? What does it affect? I mean, my first story for The Record actually was just, I had just gotten the job. I was still doing education. But they announced the new bus terminal, that they had three proposals. And so my editor literally shouted to me from his desk, which my desk was very close by, but he's like, can you cover this bus terminal thing? Like, just figure it out, you know? And so I just had to listen to this meeting, like start reading what has already been written about it and just try to quit. And then I discovered the RPA. I'd never even heard of the Regional Plan Association. And I was like, maybe they can weigh in on this, and, you know, right. So it's just kind of like, you know, working at a really fast pace and trying to keep up with everyone else. And so that it creates a very steep learning curve, which can be a good thing. So.
Right. And I know we talked about Dustin in terms of just media in general, some of the consolidation, and almost like lack of support in terms of, you know, funding and for jobs in that space. I hope that you have a lot of job security, considering there seems to be an endless path of stories, at least as of right now, as it relates to New Jersey Transit, and as being covering new transit in general, and much of it being New Jersey Transit. I just know from speaking to others that people rely heavily on your work specifically. There's a couple other reporters in New Jersey as well that do a great job, but without it, I think it would you know, we would be missing a huge space, you know, obviously New Jersey Transit being, you know, for pre-pandemic 900,000 riders or more. And then you add any other transportation stuff that you cover, without a voice in the press for to investigate or write about, or, you know, without it, I think it would be a tremendous detriment to, you know, riders like myself that need to know what's going on and stuff like that. So very much appreciated. So thank you for your work. To jump right into to the actual the good stuff, I guess. What have you been writing about recently? I mean, I've read so many headlines, it feels like, in the last, I don't know, several weeks or even longer, related to, let's talk about New Jersey Transit first, if you don't mind, related to audit, kind of whistleblower type stuff, auditors, board members, sexual harassment allegations. So can you put some of that in perspective for us in terms of, because the timelines even get a little mixed up for someone who's trying to follow it. It's been so often. So what's been going on in New Jersey Transit as it relates to some of that culture type of press that you've been writing about?
Yeah, it's been a constant headline, and I feel like readers probably feel like they've read the same headline because they have more or less, you know, multiple times now this summer, which is, I mean, what's happening is that we're starting to see this deluge, I guess, of people at their wits' end with their employment at transit, and who his last resort at this point is to file a lawsuit because they're not being heard, their issues aren't being addressed, they feel like they can't go to work because they're being harassed, sexually assaulted, stalked in some cases, you know, filing complaints about all of this and it going nowhere. These are the allegations that are being made in, you know, just four lawsuits in 4 months this summer. And many, many more predate those over the years. So unfortunately, I think what we're seeing is just a lot of the same issues and problems with the what's alleged to be a toxic workplace environment not being addressed. So I think these aren't probably going to be the last that we see. I think there's going to be many more. And I think there's much deeper issues here. And I've tried to highlight that to some extent in the stories that I've written, because the stories that I've written have been about, yes, this lawsuit was filed, this is what the experience was for these women. But also, here's how this has been talked of. These same issues have been talked about over and over and over again, you know, and going back a decade or more. So, you know, I think there's a lot more there as far as, you know, that needs to be addressed. And it hasn't been yet.
Right. And that's interesting you say that, because that's objective work that you do. And like you said, it's a continue. It seems like I agree. For me, it seems like I'm reading the same headline every day, just with a different name, but it's very serious stuff. I would guess that you reach out to New Jersey Transit to get a statement on certain things. I know you, obviously, as we said, you have other sources as well. So do they provide statements as it relates to, let's go with some of the recent stuff we've seen in regards to the six women, I believe it was, who filed sexual, and then an additional one in terms of the police department. You could talk a little bit about that. But does New Jersey Transit put a statement out? Do they tell you what they're doing to mitigate these types of things, or how does that usually work?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I mean, yeah, so I always ask for comment from New Jersey. We're in constant contact, oftentimes multiple times a day, with their press office. And when it comes to lawsuits, it's not unusual that any company or person or agency will defer to this. We declined to comment due to pending litigation, which is fine. I mean, you can comment, you're just choosing not to. And I understand why, because you're in a liable situation. You don't want to make yourself more susceptible to liability. But on the other hand, I think at this point, particularly with these allegations of sexual harassment, some of which have overwhelming evidence against the alleged perpetrators, I think you have to say something as an agency. And in particular, in this case, because your alleged perpetrators are employees and your accusers are employees. So I think you're really sending a message by not saying much or not saying anything to your 12,000 employees. Many of them are women and many of them feel ostracized in these environments, in the bus yards, in rail maintenance facilities, the New Jersey Transit Police Department in some cases.
No, those are all good points. What can you refresh our memories on what happened with the police department? That was one of the more recent. Well, the allegations aren't recent.
Right.
But the story came out. What happened with that one?
Yeah, so a former New Jersey Transit Police officer, a woman, filed a lawsuit in August accusing a supervisor in the New Jersey Transit Police Department of sexually assaulting her after a series of work event, basically. They went back to her apartment. She was driven home by this person, according to her. This is according to her version in the lawsuit. You know, and it, I mean, we didn't print some of the more graphic allegations okay. that she made, but I mean, basically she says that she woke up naked in her bed and this individual was leaving her bed and kissing her goodbye. And then from there that she did not, her complaint, she was dissuaded from complaining, she says, both internally, with the internal complaint process and to the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office because of some interactions she had with people that I think that made her uncomfortable, she says. But that is part of this theme, this concept, at least as far as New Jersey Transit is concerned, where internal complaints, you know, not going anywhere, which in her case, apparently she signed a form saying that she would not continue with the internal complaint process. That said, I'm not sure why New Jersey Transit, if they knew that a serious enough allegation like the one that she described to her peers existed, why it does not behoove them to pursue a stronger investigation or a bigger investigation into those claims. That's not my job. I don't run an HR, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But, like you said, you're reporting on the allegations of the lawsuit and what was said. You're not,
right.
That's what they are. And there's been a lot of them, and that one is, you know, they seem to get more alarming than the previous ones, to me at least. And very serious, and the pattern seems to be increasing. Would you say that you've written more about this type of thing recently than you've only been there? I mean, it's been 2 years-ish. Has it been increasing in the last several months?
I don't know if it's been increasing or not. I really can't say. Because from what I can tell, these lawsuits have been filed, these types of lawsuits with some similar allegations have been filed again, going back. I mean, in that most recent story involving the New Jersey Transit police officer, I did a timeline at the very bottom of that detailing, I think almost 10 lawsuits that were filed going back to 2009. And again, they were kind of all similar themes in some ways. So I have talked to more people. I have more sources now than I did perhaps when I started. And so I knew some of these were coming and that's how I got introduced to
litigation. So basically, just to be clear, the reporting might've been increased on the topics, but the actual events Don't know. There's no specific objective data point to know if it's been going on for a long time, if it's increased, decreased. That's not for.
I will say that I get the sense that there are many more people, many more women who are probably working for New Jersey Transit that, you know, might not be in the lawsuit, the litigation world, but have probably made similar internal complaints and have had similar issues. And, you know, they just might not be litigating those.
Right. So that's what I wonder about. And then there's also, like, obviously there's since New Jersey Transit is funded by tax, it's stacked up tax dollars for, you know, New Jersey residents like myself, or double funded if your tax dollars and you ride New Jersey Transit. People are spending money on, you know, their tax dollars are going towards this litigation, right? And there potentially could always be some level of it, but as a tax paying person who rides New Jersey Transit, that agency that should be focused on commuting, and to your points about maybe there's other things going on, I mean, would it make sense potentially to have, I know they've done, like, I think when the governor took his first term, he did an initial audit of New Jersey Transit. I'm not sure exactly what came out of it. I know there was a lot of recommendations. Maybe most of those were put in, I'm not sure. But could it make sense to maybe do something like a third party investigation on employment practices and kind of meet with different departments, or bring in sort of an inspector general? Well, there was a recent editorial, and a lot of people have kind of requested or brought this to attention, because I believe the MTA has an inspector general. So there's a lot of different ways you could get to potentially finding the root cause of culture issues that are documented via factual, objective reporting that you're doing. And do you have any thoughts about that? And where would it, who could call for it if that's
right? Well, to your point about the inspector general, I was curious about this as well. And so back when I was writing a lot about the Academy alleged fraud scandal, $15 million fraud scandal, in which the Academy bus company is accused of lying on its basically invoices about bus trips and saying that they were sending buses for certain trips that they were contracted to provide for New Jersey Transit, but in fact, no buses were showing up. And so they were getting money for buses that weren't showing up, according to the AG's lawsuit. So when that case first came on into the public sphere and I started writing about that, the first thing I said to myself was, how did this go on for so long? And how did no one know about it at New Jersey Transit? We are still trying to, frankly, answer that question. And I don't think any realistic effort is being made to do that, or at least not that I know of. I know Governor Murphy has kind of asked Kevin Corbett to look into that, but I don't know the status of that supposed investigation, or at least call for that. And obviously there is still litigation going on with that. That said, I think any reasonable company, if they found out they had been defrauded by more than $15 million, would immediately want to know why or how this happened, and why it happened for, I mean, according to the AG's complaint, it was for like 7 years, but they even acknowledged that it probably went on longer than that. And I certainly have documented that it probably went on longer than that. So I wanted to know, okay, we have these internal auditors, which we heard from now a couple of them, who wrote into the paper about, you know, what they saw and heard at the department, that they raised red flags about Academy and other issues that seemed to go unnoticed or unheeded. But I wondered, you know, an inspector general, why isn't any of the internal audit work public? Why don't we have press releases about it? Why don't we have any reports from them about like what's going on? And so as I did the research on this, and I wrote a whole story about this partially, but an internal audit department is supposed to be just private in, again, internal, like truly it is supposed to make changes so that the company can work to fix its problems amongst themselves.
I think a lot of people could understand that from the private sector.
So that makes sense. Exactly.
Yeah.
An inspector general is typically something that is written into law to oversee an agency. And so Amtrak has one, it's written into law. The MTA has one. I'm pretty sure it must be written into law for them to have one. And then those people are appointed, or they have some process of appointing, you know, a head and then an office of people who sometimes work in conjunction with an internal audit department to do audits and other, you know, fact finding missions and you know, whatever. But I think I raised the idea of whether or not New Jersey Transit should have an inspector general at the time, because it seemed to me that they needed something like that, and they need a public way to talk about this kind of work, because what was being done with the internal audit department was being shrouded in secrecy with the audit committee, and then never seeming to get the work of that committee never seemed to get to the full board. Senator Weinberg, when I asked her about that, kind of leaned into that a full board would fulfill that, gap or something, or that kind of watchdog element. I'd be curious what other people think about that, or if she even still, I mean, this was now months ago that I talked to her about that, but I would be curious if that's something she still believes. But so, yes, I think the inspector general is definitely a conversation that people are or should be having. But it would take, you know, an act of the legislature to do that. And I think it also begs the question, how would someone be appointed to run that? Do we want another governor appointment at that agency? I think is a valuable question and something that we're talking about right now as far as the reform bills that, you know, Senator Weinberg has talked about and is pushing for. Your other question was about a bigger audit of the agency as a whole.
Yeah, and specifically related to culture, because from my perspective, if there's a backward-driven, taxpayer-funded, potentially toxic culture, then how do you, if you can't fix that, then how do you work on making trains work and run on time if things like that are getting in the way of progress potentially or slowing it down?
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, it's a big agency. It's, you know, 12,000 people, and getting change there is going to be challenging. And to change a workplace environment that some people perceive as toxic, that's no small, there's no small potatoes there as far as like trying to, you know, modify that or improve it. So yeah, I mean, I certainly think it would be a worthwhile investment. You know, if these allegations are to be believed, that they should.
I mean, whether the allegations are true or not, someone still has to investigate them. So there's still money being spent on them.
Yep.
So that means, and there is some sort of pattern of them. So whether they're all false or not, someone's paying for it. So.
And actually, I should add to this. So part of some of the lawsuits, I believe the ones involving the bus operators, the four bus operators, part of their, they're not just asking for damages and money, right? They're asked, part of what their lawsuit says is that they want to see substantive change at the agency. And they have it written into their, basically like demands as part of the lawsuit. So they're not just doing this because they want to get rich or something, which obviously isn't going to happen if they win at all. But they want real change. These women want to be able to go to work and feel comfortable going to work every day, which currently they don't. So anyway, again, I think, yeah, that there is a, appetite for real change. And, if an audit is what it takes to do that, then, you know, certainly I think it's a worthwhile investment.
No, it's good color. And especially on, I didn't realize that, that they're attaching those types of requests to, and I know this is starting like a big legal conversation, which is odd because it's, we're talking about transit, but they're attaching like changes that they'd like to be seen in the organizational culture to what has been done to them, which shows that they want it to be improved. So if anyone is listening who is involved with New Jersey Transit leadership or governance and has the ability to potentially call for changes, it'd be interesting. It sounds like people are trying to do it. They're coming out and speaking out about it. But in order to, you know, potentially provide more of a comprehensive approach to something like this, to your point about the 12,000 employees and things like that, it's not easy, but the taxpayers deserve more. The people that are coming forth deserve more, and the people that are in silence deserve more. So hopefully something happens. And I guess, would you say that that would be potentially the board's decision to make? So the board is a big part, like you said. And when I spoke to Senator Weinberg, she was on this podcast very recently. And like you said, she does say, you know, we can't legislate Jersey Transit we can't control it from the legislature. We can write bills, put in governance and hopes. So she's really putting a lot of political capital into the board. So is that where the change could be made in terms of something like this from your perspective?
Look, I think it's a worthwhile question because I don't exactly know the answer, but I think it is absolutely a worthwhile question for the board, you know, to say, can we, you know, initiate an audit or initiate some kind of an overview of this agency and what we perceive as those big issue items like a toxic work environment, concerns about retribution and other, sexual harassment and sexual assault and things like that. I think at the very least, the question should be asked. And I have a feeling there are board members who are, if they're not asking that question specifically, would be interested in at least exploring it.
Absolutely.
And I don't see why they, I mean, it seems to me that they probably could, you know, do that and that they have the authority to do that, but I'm not exactly sure. I don't have their bylaws in front of me.
Right.
I'm not as familiar with them, but.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it would potentially have to come from the governor or if they'd be able to do it.
Well, it would probably have to come from the commissioner. I have a feeling she would have to be very involved in making that happen. Would have to be.
The chair of the board.
With her, yeah, she would have to be on board with it, I think.
Okay. And to your point, I'm sure that I would hope that they're looking into it in certain ways, but maybe just a full-blown public facing
at least to send a message again to your employees and to what is one of the biggest employers in the state, I think, who wants to attract top talent to continue this, what is being talked about as a transformation of this agency. These headlines and these allegations are not going to help them attract that talent. And if they can at least, like you said, create kind of a public facing, like, we're taking this seriously, we're looking into these topics and these concerns. Here's how we're doing it.
And it seems like an endless topic, unfortunately. There was a board member that recently resigned, correct? So can you talk to us a little bit about where we stand on the transit reform bill from 2018 that was passed by the New Jersey State Legislature and signed into law by Governor Murphy? What is left? What's outstanding? And also as it relates to the recent board resignation?
Right. So yes. So that the 2018 reform bill that Governor Murphy signed, that was authored by Loretta Weinberg, Bob Gordon, who's now on the board. There are several outstanding elements of that law. Chief among them is the customer advocate, continues to be an unfilled position. We'll be coming up on a year now where that will have been vacated. So why there hasn't been any movement on that, I mean, who knows why that is. There is supposed to be a chief ethics officer who is appointed by the board. I don't know why that hasn't been filled. When I inquired about it back in like 2019 going into 2020, which was around the time a year was passing for that reform legislation, I was told by the commissioner that they were waiting for a full board to exist in order to then make a big decision like that, which made sense. Weinberg agreed with that assessment of why they should wait to appoint that person. Now, they don't have a full board now, but they do have more people sitting on there, and I think they have eight or nine people sitting. So they, you know, it seems like that could be done. I would be curious what that conversation is like right now, if they're even having that conversation. The other thing that really doesn't get talked about either, and I, you know, haven't written about it explicitly, but I believe one other element of this is that they were supposed to rewrite their bylaws, the board, but perhaps that's also being tied to this full board element. Now, the full board is a big problem because there are multiple people missing from seats, some in more mysterious reasons than others. Right. So as you noted recently, the David Rasmussen, who represented the rail, one of the bigger rail unions, resigned because he was accused of in some kind of insurance fraud, kind of a kickback scheme idea. It seemed, I was a little bit honestly confused about what exactly this fraud method was, but he just resigned. The bus labor union representative kind of mysteriously resigned, and it's unclear. It was never really talked about at any meeting or acknowledged publicly that he had left. It was just kind of realized that he stopped showing up to meetings. So I know he kind of, Ray Greaves kind of, I think has gone higher in the rail union organization, but I'm not sure why that hasn't been replaced. It's fuzzy. And then we are left with also two other board appointments who are public members, who at least one of them is supposed to be a bus rider. The other is supposed to be an expert of some kind, and transit is a very broad expertise definition. But that is, again, a little bit of a mystery because there were two names that existed. They existed for months. In May of 2020, they were supposed to be going through the confirmation process with the Senate. And at the 11th hour, I mean, just days before, they had already met with senators, these two individuals, and Governor Murphy yanked their appointments, because apparently it was realized that one of them was not this, the one that was his kind of pick was not a bus rider. Now, I had raised questions about whether this person was qualified or was a bus rider months prior, and kind of got really no response or not much of a response about that. So people had already been talking about this. So I don't know why it was all of a sudden realized and needed to be done, and why both names needed to be yanked. Last 2 Mays ago. But nonetheless, here we are, and a bus rider has not been found. I know Len Resto and many other people have put their hands up as potential candidates. I think there are obviously hundreds of thousands of bus riders who could be candidates for this role and the other role. So it's unclear. I've never gotten a clear answer on what the holdup is there or why this can't move ahead. So that is a really frustrating thing. And I think the fewer eyes you have on the board means the fewer people that are keeping an eye on this agency that clearly, I mean, within its own ranks, within its own board ranks, has allegations of fraud. So there are some deep issues there. And I think not having the board members doesn't send a great message. And I know Governor Murphy has been quoted saying that he doesn't think that commuters, standing on the platform are concerned about the board when they're waiting for their train or bus. And frankly, I think that insults the intelligence a little bit of your constituency and your commuters who do care about these issues and about the larger concerns at play when it comes to how this agency runs and who is setting those policy tones, you know, from a board seat.
Yeah, that's very similar to what Senator Weinberg said. So if anyone's listening, tune in to the end of the Senator Weinberg discussion to hear her thoughts on that exact statement by Governor Murphy in terms of asking riders if they care about who their board members are or something along those lines. It's seeming like that since there's a lot going on with culture type of events in your reporting, that it's going to take up a lot of the pretty much this whole time. We might have to get back together to talk about some of the other stuff. But while we're on it, we're talking about like kind of governance of those things that we talked about earlier about bills, you know, legislation, and things like that. Have you had any interaction with Kevin Corbett or just anything in general from a CEO of, Kevin Corbett's the CEO of New Jersey Transit. Any, I think since Murphy has been governor, just do you have any insights into what people think of him in terms of what's been told to you by either internally or externally people? I mean, you know my thoughts on him, but others, what's the story, you know, that what do people think about the CEO of the agency that as told to you from others?
Well, I think there's a mixed bag there. I think there are people who wanted to see more immediate results and who want things to be done differently and don't like him and want him out and want someone else to come in. I think others have taken a more wait and see position. And I think there is an element where there have been many things that have gotten checked off. As far as, again, we saw PTC get done. We saw these the locomotive engineers, which was a big problem that seems to have gotten checked off. They've ordered more trains, which doesn't help the current, you know, failures that they're seeing. But, you know, anyway, so I think that there are several things that he came in to do and he is doing and that Murphy wanted to see checked off. Also the capital plan is, you know, something that's probably more his bread and butter, I think, honestly, is like that sort of work. Mm-hmm. But I think there's still a lot to be desired. I think obviously the agency is far from being fixed. And I think that there's a lot of people still, you know, trying to wait and see if there's going to be more substantive, real people feel the changes. And we really haven't gotten a good litmus test on that yet because of the pandemic, I guess, you know, and are people's commutes going to feel like they've changed? Do they feel like they can get to work reliably? And that's the message that he has been putting out there, that he wants people to feel like they can rely on this transit, you know, commuter organization where they couldn't before. And so when I last spoke to him, which was for that commuter story about the return to commute, what is it going to look like for the fall? Are you prepared to adjust schedules despite there's challenges with, especially with rail changing a schedule if, you know, they're seeing more people riding at certain hours and things like that. There's just not as much flexibility there. But I wanted to get a feel from him about whether or not they were prepared to be as flexible as possible for what could be a very new world of commuting. And he assured me that they are keeping a close eye at, you know, really a granular level of these, of the numbers of when people are riding, what their expectations are. But, you know, I think it kind of remains to be seen, you know, how people really feel and what commuting is going to look like, you know, when there are more people actually back And so whether that's going to be this fall, honestly, like, I feel like day to day, like I had that conversation with him, you know, weeks ago. By the time the story got up, I mean, I feel like we're almost in a whole new position as far as the Delta variant and other coronavirus issues. So yes, we will see. And I mean, there is just going to be a much lower threshold for cleanliness, you know, issues. People are not going to tolerate that. I don't think they are going to, you know, that's just one issue, but delays. I mean, I got caught in a train, a major delay, which wasn't New Jersey Transit's fault. It was one of the freight carriers, but a train was delayed for like almost 2 hours. I was trying to get to Secretary Buttigieg's press conference and I almost missed it because I was waiting for trains, which, you know, like I said, isn't their fault, but it's just this, you know, issue of, you know, do people feel like they can rely on it and rely on it to be clean and there when they want it to be. So that remains to be seen, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't for some people because they have been taking trains and buses this whole time.
Right. Good, both good points. And also, also worth noting the stuff that you said about positive train control, which was a delayed but implemented safety measure that I think pretty much every mass transit rail association has.
Commuter rail, yeah,
commuter rail, and the, I think it's a global, if not,
and like that ship is not like fully sailed. I mean, you have to maintain that system now. So money needs to continue to be poured into that. Training probably still needs to take place for new employees about how that works. And, you know, there could be software glitches, you know, so that's something that we still need to pay attention to. And I think
we'll yeah, we haven't heard, I mean, I haven't heard anything since they celebrated it with the FTA or whoever was there at the end of 2020, when they got the sign off that it was done. But it did have a couple, and I heard it wasn't
uncommon. I understand that they did meet those other goals that they needed, those other deadlines, benchmarks that they needed to meet.
So that's obviously a positive, as well as, like you said, something that should be noticeable to rail riders, which would be, or rail commuters, which would be that restoring the engineer ranks, which was, you know, seen as maybe the most common reason for cancellations prior. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's now, according to the administration or New Jersey Transit, they're now at a level that they want to be at. So any engineer related shortages as it relates to train cancellations should not exist anymore, correct? Is that what
should be extremely minimal? Yeah.
Which kind of leaves open the kind of the mechanical issues, which
right, which I know you were talking about, because I think you found yourself on trains or experiencing delays, right, because of some mechanical failure issues.
Right, that seems to be the new engineer one.
And like, frankly, that was always there. It just wasn't as bad as the other issue.
Kind of makes you wonder about the reporting system, because I don't know, we don't have the numbers in front of us for, like, they have the on-time metrics and cancellations and they bucket them into different things on the website. But like you said, it was always there. And I've taken the train a few times as we get back to work here. And I believe it might be number one but they account for mechanical.
Well, issues. If I recall that, I didn't write I don't believe I wrote about that at the time, but it was probably the new numbers reported by the FTA or something like
it
that.
It was something like that from a government body or agency.
But I also think, just if I'm remembering this correctly too, that they may have had the highest number of failures, but as a percentage of their track mileage or revenue miles, I don't think that it was number one.
Oh, okay, that's a good point. I saw that story, I think, in the Star Ledger.
Yes.
So yeah, I don't have all the details. I just know that it was very high in these raw numbers.
Even regardless of that, I think they're very aware of their faults and issues with mechanical failures. But again, I mean, I think to give them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, I mean, with trains and fixing trains, like he came in 2018 and ordering new trains takes forever. I mean, I don't think that's their fault. But hopefully these multi-levels, you know, that they get are in good shape, that they will help bring down that median, you know, or mean average failure rate, you know, per train. That only time will tell. And hopefully also, I mean, if they really are serious about this capital plan and the work that they're doing, that the reinvestment in rail, and hopefully with Amtrak as well, because they share so much rail areas, that they're updating their signals, that they're upgrading their, you know, rail, so that derailments and other issues like that are improved, and therefore, you know, make the whole system just that much smoother. But we'll have to see.
Absolutely. And also, I just want to point out, like, obviously, maybe next time we'll get into Gateway and all those positive developments in terms of the tunnels and progress, to your point about you going to out to see the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg. Was that focused on Gateway and infrastructure bill funding, or what was the main focus of that?
That was essentially what that visit was about, was pushing the infrastructure bill, which has huge implications for the Gateway Tunnel and the other projects related to that. I mean, you know, it was interesting because he met with like 18 or 20 mayors from kind of the central-ish Jersey area. So it was kind of an interesting dynamic, you know, one mayor to the next, who can really relate to a lot of their issues. But what I tried to say in my story was, I think in talking to the mayors of this region, he's gonna be talking to people who probably more than any mayor in any other town, except for maybe New York City, know a lot about transportation and have become by de facto experts on this, because their constituents have so many problems. They have so many problems trying to get to and from home and work in the city for recreation or whatever the issue is.
Good point.
So they know what they're talking about. And so it was a really, they had a roundtable event and it was, I mean, you had to know your stuff talking to them. And I will have to say that I think Pete Buttigieg seemed to really be up on his homework. He knew the issues. He knew the the talking points.
Yeah,
going to be most.
I think everyone's excited about that, having that smaller town feel of what transportation needs, and then to look at it big picture and smart guy and
hoping. Yeah, new ideas. That, I think.
Right.
And taking
the job seriously, opposed to previous administrations, like, as far as I know, many going back, where it's been like a little bit of a patronage spot to put someone in to run that organization within the federal government. And, you know, it seems like Secretary Buttigieg is taking it very seriously. And
I think transportation at its core is, at the end of the day, local issues. There's Amtrak, which is, you know, a national organization and rail system. But at the end of the day, most transportation issues are hyper local, and they have to do with the roads and the tracks and the buses that affect people on an extremely hyper local level. And so I think that, you know, with his unique perspective and who took an interest in improving on a really local level his community, the way that their town, their roads were redesigned, they had pedestrian and walkways implemented and stuff like that. It will be very interesting to see what he's able to do. I think with a department that as kind of a reputation of being a little, I think, kind of stuffy, you know, yeah, and just
exactly
not very progressive.
Right. So definitely, hopefully a lot of benefits to come from that. And when you were speaking about the mayors in Central Jersey and how they're kind of de facto experts, I recall like either reading it and just from being close by where I live, places like Westfield, you know, places where they have transit, they have rail stations, the very well-known towns, great communities, but they don't have direct they don't have a direct ride into Manhattan from their town. So they've been advocating for a quote unquote one seat ride right. into New York for, I don't know, as long as, you know, New Jersey Transit's probably been running. And I know they have some off peak one seat rides maybe, but it makes sense to me why that would be top of the mind for that type of engagement that you were talking about. And then as it relates to Gateway, obviously there'd be more capacity to do stuff like that. But in the meantime, I mean, Gateway's, I mean, how many years away would you guess if we're just going through the commissions? Let's say everyone does their job. I don't want to get too much in detail because we're probably running out of time. Patients listening are probably running thin. But like, if Gateway were to be like kind of fast tracked, what's your feelings on when a real tunnel? I know there was something that was started, but when would a tunnel could it be utilized, an additional one? If it was fast track, just like a rough guess, and we won't hold you to it, but it will be forever in the social media podcast world.
I mean, I think like, again, this is just kind of a gut instinct, I guess, but just, I think the soonest you could see a new tunnel up and running at the very earliest, I mean, 7 years, 8 years, if it's the fastest tunnel ever built,
right?
You know,
well, that would be amazing.
I think something that this region needs to grapple with, and I think is being studied and talked about behind closed doors, but isn't, nobody wants to be alarmist. But I think it's a very real possibility that a tunnel needs to be shut down for extensive repairs before we can get a new one up and running. I really think that is a very strong possibility.
Right. You're talking about the current tunnels and the 100-year-old tunnels and the decay from things like Hurricane Sandy and stuff like that.
And I think, again, to Kevin Corbett's credit, I will say that it seems that this is maybe even not about that necessarily specifically, but keeping in mind that redundancy and basically diversified assets to get across that river is critical no matter what. If there's a hurricane, it's important to have that because, you know, the rails were shut down for how many weeks during Sandy? They needed buses. So, you know, this all works and ferries, you know, are critical. They were critical during 9/11, for instance, you know, so having that, knowing that diversifying those assets across the river is important, and it's going to be especially critical if a tunnel fails. So I think they're shoring up, you know, Hoboken to be maybe more equipped, you know, with the fill-in that they're doing there. They're also redoing the electrical there, which I didn't know about until recently, so that they'll have multiple, you know, it's not one big, if the electric goes out at Hoboken, the whole thing goes out. And I think they're redoing that to be a little bit more flexible. The ferry service, and this is the other thing at New Jersey Transit that Kevin Corbett was telling me when I was talking about this commuter to him about this commuter story, is that they are studying, you know, alternative transit over the Hudson River, which is just, I think, a good study, but also because of some underlying concerns that the tunnels will need to be shut down eventually, and whether or not that happens before a new tunnel is built remains to be seen. But I think everyone is very aware, maybe not talking about it publicly, but of the very real possibility of that happening sooner than we think.
Well, you're talking about it publicly, so there you go.
Yeah, I'm here to talk to Eric.
But that makes a lot of sense. Like, if you're paid to run a transit agency or with others, that crosses and provides, you know, a significant portion of GDP and economic growth for this country, and cannot really literally afford for it not to work, to not have a contingency plan as even regular businesses have for whatever work that they specialize in, makes a lot of sense. I always thought too personally that when it comes to these derailments or things when back, you know, pre-pandemic again, and we'll probably be back to it when the trains become more, you know, fuller. When you have these massive derailments that create, you know, that's what you see on TV, and, you know, you probably write about it when Penn Station fills up. You know, to your point earlier, it's like it's going to happen, but you don't know when. And I never saw, there's not really like a hard and fast, like, okay, if there's a derailment in the tunnel and you have during rush hour people leaving work, what are the alternatives? Like, they're cross-honoring on the path or something like that. But you're literally down in Penn Station and with kind of thousands of people, and you don't know, you're not being told really what's going on. You don't know there's a derailment usually, or what the issue is. So you're playing like a little bit of a balancing act to get home, and there's no like, okay, this is what we should do. We have buses lined up at Port Authority. They're going to all the major transit hubs, or they're going to Hoboken. Then we have a kind of a contingency plan to get people out. So not related to the tunnels necessarily, like completely shutting down, but just related to these common things that we saw maybe once a month or something like that, that impacted so many people, so many commuters, and that seemed to be no really consistent backup plan. And then what I would notice is the next day, no one would be on the train. They just gave up for like the next day or the week. And it would just happen over and over again. And there would be no like post-mortem on what happened. You'd be lucky to pick it up in like one of your stories or on the news, or you'd find out 3 days later that it wasn't a mechanical error and someone fell asleep or something like that.
Right.
So I just wonder about those things as we get back on the rails, as people get back to work and things like that. And to your point about people not being used to or maybe comfortable in large crowds and things like that. So I just wonder how they're going to handle it. I haven't heard anything. So thank you for joining us, Colleen. We really appreciate it. There was a couple questions that did come in, if you don't mind, before we part ways. I think we talked about maybe some of these, but after Senator Weinberg retires, who do you think will take up her mantle on public transit advocacy within the legislature, if anyone? What is your take on that?
Ooh, well, yeah, I mean, that's a question I've been wondering myself. And I think I asked you that with Gordon Johnson coming on.
And he, by the way, to the benefit of that, if anyone were to watch that, he said he will be the advocate for the district and for the county and for New Jersey. So
yeah,
with all due respect to that, and we might need more than one. Who else? Let's say Gordon's there, he's on it. Who's next? Is there going to be anyone?
I mean, they are such big shoes to fill. And I mean, just from my perspective, I mean, Senator Weinberg, not only obviously being an advocate for commuters, who talk to commuters all the time, who obviously made it her mission to make that a huge part of her work. But from my perspective, she also picked up the phone when I called. I didn't have to go through a process to get a quote or to ask a question. I just called her and asked, which is a lost art in this world of PR and journalism and where that meets. So from that perspective as well, like, that is something. Now, I there are a handful of other legislators that I talk to whose cell phone I have, who I can call and ask, you know, for comments. So there are other people, but as far as like filling her shoes as the commuter advocate,
Nobody comes to mind.
I don't know. There's a couple. I mean, I wonder, you know, Dan Benson is the transportation chair, committee chair for the assembly. You know, hopefully he's someone that that could fill those, you know, gaps. You know, I spoke to Joseph Lagana a lot because I wrote a lot of stories with some peers down in Asbury about school bus legislation, and his district had that terrible crash in Mount Olive a couple years ago, and he worked on all these bills about that and is still working on legislation about that. So, but also, like, some of the major coach companies are based in, I think Coach actually is based in Paramus. So I know he has bus constituents who, you know, so who knows, maybe he could be someone that also kind of picks that baton up. But again, I mean, I just have not gotten the impression that anyone has the same level of enthusiasm and passion for the topic and for those constituents and their issues, quite like Loretta Weinberg, who is a regular attendee, or was in some ways a regular attendee of the Port Authority, of you know, New Jersey Transit Board meetings, and the like. So it's a big job to fill. But to me, I don't know why it's not like a bigger issue or way to meet constituents for legislatures, because, or for legislators in the legislature, because I mean, it's
seems like, you know, if you
bipartisan, you know, it's like
you want to take that on and make that part of your running platform, I think you'd get a lot of support. But yeah, potentially people don't want to get involved with something that they believe might be not solution oriented. But I think as residents, if I speak for myself only, even if they're trying, I'm sure they would get a lot of attention.
Positive on this, I think. And, you know, that's
a good point. Last question was, what are the most surprising and or amusing anecdotes you've heard from commuters' experiences in New Jersey? So like just a funny or crazy commuting story, does anything come to mind?
Well, so from something we were talking about earlier and about like commuters going, you know, showing up to this almost like predictable, like chaotic scene, especially at Penn Station, but also the bus terminal. I had someone once tell me, like, use this great kind of anecdote, like, it's like a calculus. You have to do a calculus to figure out how to get home. If something happens at Penn Station, then you have to go to the bus terminal, you have to go to PATH, you have to go to, and it's this like, and you have to check all these different things on Twitter or like, or the news or whatever to see, okay, how am I going to get home? Like, what is the best course of action for me? And it's almost like a war game. So I kind of, that was like something I just, is a little bit funny that someone once.
No, that's a good one, because it's very true. And I think a lot of people that are listening that commute, that do that.
They totally do that.
You're about to leave work and you check like departure vision. If everything's canceled, you get onto, you know, the
just the likelihood of it being like canceled, like,
or like,
do you have a feeling about it today? Do you have like a gut?
Right. And I personally wasn't good at that. So fortunately, like, people would start texting me like, hey, trains are messed up, you know, be aware or whatever. And so that was always but it's a good point. And it goes back to like our contingency discussion. It would be cool if like New Jersey Transit would blast, you know, put out a blast when there's something impacting more than X percentage of train lines to draw someone's attention into potentially making alternative travel plans home, so that you don't end up in the bottom of Penn Station,
yes,
buried with it, thousands of people. Cool. So I really appreciate it. Is there any, you get the last word. Thank you for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. Appreciate all the work that you do, of course. It's very valuable to New Jersey, for sure. But you get the last word. Do you have anything to share with us, or anything to leave us with?
Yeah, well, thank you so much. You were super complimentary, and that was really nice of you, and really appreciated. Yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation. I think kind of hashing these out, kind of giving a little bit of a, you know, the background of, and some of the stuff that happens behind the scenes is kind of, you know, a cool thing to talk about. And I enjoyed that. But yeah, I mean, like, keep reading, hopefully subscribing. I hope people do. And to stay in touch with me, because that is the best way to know what's happening out there, what your concerns are, where you want to see, where, what you want to read. And I am very receptive to that sort of thing. You know, you and I talk all the time about ideas, and it's really valuable. So,
good one. That's a good point. Reach out to Colleen. She's on Twitter. She's on email. She's on Facebook.
Yep. It's
easy to find, and definitely you include a diverse set of voices, it seems, when you do your great reporting. So that's great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And I heard you had a little one. So congratulations.
Thank you. Yes. He couldn't be here today with us, but I'm sure he's spitting up on someone else's shirt right now.
4-month-old, right?
4 months old. Yep.
So you're getting a lot of sleep as you're doing all this great reporting, I assume.
Yeah, I get a lot of my work done now at 5 a.m. or whenever I'm up.
Oh my gosh.
In the middle of the night.
Well, congratulations on that as well. We wish everyone the best. And thank you again. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Bye.
Where the talk is real. Garden State Debate. No joke, no frills. Garden State Debate. It's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate. For people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate.
Garden State Debate.
Garden State Debate.